Thanks for that, Jordan. And with no further ado, let's ask Brother Simon up to speak to us for his first study for end of years, to the elect aliens.
Sorry, I'm negotiating on the time. Well, it's lovely to see you all. Thanks for the invitation to come over to speak to you all on this wonderful occasion, the end of year studies. What a special time it is for the ecclesias in Perth and the young people. I understand they've just been on a fantastic weekend, and that's been a really invigorating thing for them. That's been happily something that's led really well into our studies, because they've been looking at the man Peter. And as a lead up to our studies together this week, that's been just a fantastic introduction for them. To the older ones amongst us, you've missed out on that, so we might do a little bit on that in our first study, just to sort of get a sense of who the author of this epistle is. And we know Peter well, of course, but there's just a few things we might touch upon as by way of background in consideration of this man Peter. I've got a lot of friends in the room. I visited Perth first in 1985 for the youth conference that was held in that year here on Genesis 1 to 6, I think it was. It's probably people in this room that were at that conference. And it was my first visit to Perth, and since then I've been back on quite a few occasions and have met a lot of people and know a lot of people. I'm looking forward to catching up with you and also meeting new people who we haven't met before. Priscilla's here with me, and also four of my children are here. Nathan, Joanna, Sam and Abigail. And though all four of them were at the young people's camp, and they had a great time, so thanks for the hospitality that you've already shown our children. So look around for our children and say hi to them, and hopefully they behaved well at the camp. And if they didn't, go and see Priscilla. The other thing I just want to mention before we start is that we can't cover 1 Peter in four studies and an exhort incomprehensively. So what we're going to try to do is touch upon the main themes to try to get an understanding of who the readers were and why Peter chose to speak about the things he did to that group of people. To try to give you the big picture, as it were, of this group of brothers and sisters, where they lived, what they were experiencing, and hopefully why then what Peter is saying is relevant to them and how it can be relevant to us in a similar context. So that's going to be our aim, and I just want to take it off the table straight away. We're not going to go verse by verse through five chapters of Peter. We just don't have time to do it. I'd love to do that, but we couldn't do it justice in the time available. So rather than do that, we're going to really just concentrate on the big ideas. And then you can easily slot in every other verse into the big picture, because everything Peter is saying in his whole epistle really fits into one big theme. There is really only one big theme in Peter, and everything fits into that. And once you understand the big picture, the big theme that he's addressing, everything he said to those brothers and sisters becomes clear. And you can think about how is this relevant in the context. You can see that everything he says, every chapter, every verse that he writes, bolsters that big encouragement that he is trying to present to his readers. All right, well, we don't tend to write letters much anymore, do we? We SMS, we Facebook, we email perhaps. But letter writing is fast becoming a lost art. When I was a young person, you wrote a lot of letters to your friends and your girlfriends. And letters are quite powerful. When I was receiving letters from my friends, and I wrote letters to my friends when I was young, they were quite a powerful mode of communication. When you received a letter, you opened it with excitement. You know, you would go to the post box, you'd get it out, and it would be addressed to you, and you'd see on the back who it was from, and you'd open it up, and there were maybe 10 pages of writing there, and you'd open it up and think, wow, I want to read this carefully, and you'd read and weigh every word and every sentence. Because it wouldn't be something that would happen every day that you'd receive a letter. You might get a letter once a week or once a fortnight or once a month, and so you really valued your letters that you received, and you would put a lot of thought into writing a letter. You know, handwriting 10 pages, you really tried to think very carefully what you put down, and when you received the letter, not one word was missed. And sometimes you could convey ideas by letter more precisely and delicately than even face-to-face. You know, romance has perhaps lost something as a result of the lack of letter writing. Just a little tip there for the young people. LOL doesn't quite have the same expressive potential as a letter, you know. Well, when you read the letters of the apostle, it lifts to another level entirely. And if you can imagine these readers getting a letter from the apostle Peter, Peter being in Rome, Peter being going through trials of his own in the capital city of the empire. In chapter 5 he talks about that he was writing from Babylon, but I believe Babylon was code for Rome, it being the centre of the pagan empire of the time and being the seat of the dictator. And of course the symbology of Babylon was used in Revelation to talk about the Roman Empire. And I think when Peter was writing, you had to talk about Rome in code, because you're in danger of your life if you criticise Rome in any way. And they talked about in chapter 5 that Peter was writing from Babylon, and Peter talked about your adversaries like going about like a roaring lion, seeing whom he might devour. And that's like code again, because he couldn't address directly the people that were responsible for threatening the lives of the brothers and sisters to whom he was writing. So they received this letter at a very difficult time. And we can say right now that the brothers and sisters to whom Peter was writing were living in times that was threatening their very lives and the lives of their loved ones. Many of them had endured persecution, torture. Many of them had loved ones who'd been killed, who'd been executed. And they were undergoing an extreme form of trial, and we're going to discuss that in a little bit more detail tonight. When we read Peter, what you find is that it's like a barrage of spiritual ideas. It's very dense. One verse, I don't know if you got that sense there reading chapter 1, one verse conveys about 4 or 5 deep spiritual concepts. It's like all these spiritual ideas are being tossed out there and rolling over each other one by one. You think, my goodness, you know, how dense this epistle really is. And it is. And it's like he's throwing all these ideas at them. And it's not, perhaps, when you first read it, as structured as a letter of Paul is. When you study the epistles of Paul, the Apostle Paul, he wrote in a very structured way. You know, he was brought up at the feet of Gamaliel, who was very highly educated. He was very skilled in writing letters. In fact, even Paul's opponents acknowledged Paul's letter-writing ability when they said his letters are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is contemptible. So he wasn't perhaps as powerful a public speaker as he was a letter-writer. And he was able to build a persuasive and sustained argument over a number of chapters and Romans and Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, and Galatians, and these epistles are really good examples. They are well structured, and you can look at Romans and you say, well, chapters 1 to 3 are about this, and chapter 4 to 6 are about this, 7 to 8 about that, 9 to 11 is about this, and it's a building argument. You go through Corinthians in the same way. You know, chapters 1 to 4 is on this, then 5, 6, 7, 8, and it's a building argument, and it's a method of persuasion that Paul used. Whereas when you come to Peter, it's not structured in that same linear way. It's like Peter has themes woven through the epistle, and they keep coming back, and they keep coming back, and he weaves all these ideas through his epistle. I'm not saying it's not structured in any linear way, but it's more a thematic thing. And the big theme that we're going to find out is the centre of Peter's epistle is suffering. And suffering he keeps coming back to as the primary subject of his writing, and the secondary ideas of his epistle are to support what he's saying to the brothers and sisters about suffering. And so in chapter 1, when he talks about hope, when he talks about resurrection, when he talks about being born again, when he talks about being aliens, when he talks about being chosen, all these themes, they're all concentrating around the grand theme, which is suffering. And we're going to see that. And I believe in some measure, the difference in the structure of the Apostle Peter's epistle and the Apostle Paul's is their background. You know, the Apostle Paul was highly educated, and although he counted those things done, they no doubt still influenced the way he wrote. And I'm not, of course, dispensing with the important background of inspiration, but even with inspiration, it's clear that God allowed the personality of the writer to come through, even though the words were inspired and every word was inspired. Peter was a fisherman, and he was used to working with nets, and nets were woven. And he used to have a circular casting net. He'd cast it out. And the word used of Peter's net in John chapter, Mark chapter 1, is amphiblesteron or something. And it's like an amphitheatre. It's circular net. And he'd throw it out into the Lake of Galilee, and it would just sink. And they'd capture all the fish that were under it. And then Jesus, of course, called Peter, and Jesus said to Peter that you're going to be a fisher of men. And so all the skills that Peter had built up through his experience of fishing, he was to use in capturing men now, not fish, but men for Christ. And he was going to capture these men with a net, and he was going to bring them to shore, so that they would be fit for the Master's use. And I think that's what we have in the Epistle of Peter. We have a net, the gospel net of Peter. And this net was to capture men and to bring them to Christ and to keep them, not to lose them. Not one fish was to be lost in that process, if he could possibly avoid it. Now, these brothers and sisters to whom Peter were writing had been captured. They'd been baptized. But they were in danger of being lost because of the threat of persecution that they were under. And Peter was going to bring them to shore. Peter was going to make sure that his net that he threw out there for their benefit was going to capture these men for Christ. All right, well, just looking at the author of this epistle, we can recall a number of important things about Peter. First of all, there's the call of Peter. Now, let's just quickly come to John chapter 1. Peter was called. Now, the young people have done all this, so this will be a revision in some ways for you. I just want to touch on a couple of points in Peter's life. The first point I want to make is that in John chapter 1, we have the record in verse 35 of Jesus coming out of the wilderness. He'd been in the wilderness for 40 days, and he emerged after being baptized 40 days earlier by John the Baptist. He emerged from the wilderness in the same location, about the same location at which he was baptized. And it says here in verse 29, the next day John sees Jesus coming unto him, and he saith, behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. This is he of whom I said, after me comes a man which is preferred before me. And the words that are recorded there are John speaking to his disciples saying, this is the Lamb of God. And he was drawing attention to Jesus as the one who was to come, who had been baptized. Now, in verse 36 of verse 35, the next day after John stood and said those words, John stood and two of his disciples. So John was there and two of his disciples, and he again looked upon Jesus as he walked, and said, behold the Lamb of God, again. So John, you can see, is now proclaiming that this is the one of whom I have been speaking. Here he is. 2 days in a row now, he draws attention to the Lamb of God. Now, who are these two disciples? Well, in verse 37, two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. And Jesus turned and saw them following, and saith unto them, what are you seeking? And they said unto him, Rabbi, which is to say, being interpreted, Master, where dwellest thou? And he saith unto them, come and see. And they came and saw where he dwelt and abode with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. And one of the two which heard John was speaking, one of the two disciples, followed him. And it was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. And so one of those two disciples of John was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. Now, Andrew, after getting that call of Jesus and being invited to his house or the place at least at which he was staying, which was close to Jerusalem. It may have been in Bethany. It was certainly close to where John the Baptist was at work baptising, right down the southern end of the Jordan. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, is one of John the Baptist's disciples. He's down there, a long way away from Galilee, really, more than a day's journey. And then what does Andrew do? Verse 41, he first findeth his own brother Simon, and saith unto him, we have found the Messiah, which is being interpreted, the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. And when Jesus beheld him, he said, thou art Simon, son of Jonah, thou shalt be called Cephas, which is by interpretation a stone. Now, for Andrew just to go and get Peter in that way, it's clear that Peter also was around the location that John the Baptist was baptising. And it's very likely that both Andrew and Simon Peter were disciples of John the Baptist. And therefore they had a background, a strong background in the message of Messiah is about to come. They had been prepared. And so it was not just a matter of Jesus turning up at the Lake of Galilee and saying, oh, here's two men fishing, follow me, and Peter and Andrew just saying, okay, off we go. There had been a solid background laid by John to these two brothers, Andrew and Simon Peter. And they understood that Messiah was coming. And Andrew came to Peter and said, we found the Messiah. And Peter said, let's go. And when Jesus saw him, he said, you're Simon, son of Jonah. Now, Peter's father might have been called John, because that's what the word is here, Jonah. But also this might be a reference to the prophet Jonah. Now, it wasn't the only time Jesus made the point that Simon was the son of Jonah. And there's a significance in that, that just have a think about what that might be. And we might get the opportunity to speak about what that might be in a future study. Thou shalt be called Cephas, which is going to be his new name. And it means, by interpretation, a stone. Now, the stone comes up in Peter's epistle. Peter talks about us being living stones. Peter talks about Christ being the foundation stone, and that we as stones belong in the building, and that God is working to build a spiritual temple, and that we all belong there, and that Peter was one of the first stones laid in that first century ecclesia. He was to be a central and important stone. He was to be like a rock-like figure, a leader, someone who had some significance in the establishment of the first century ecclesia. So that's brought up in Peter's epistle. But we can see the background here of Peter being someone who was educated in the ways of John the Baptist. And actually at the end of chapter 1 of 1 Peter, Peter refers to John the Baptist's message. He actually quotes Isaiah 40, that John the Baptist was continually raising in his preaching. And at the end of 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter takes his readers to Isaiah 40, and he reminds them of those particular verses. And we can see that Peter's epistle is like this huge exposition of everything he has learned through his life that he can lay before his readers and say, this is what life as a disciple of Jesus is all about. All right, so we have this introduction to Peter. Now come to Mark chapter 1. And just see the next incident that Peter is involved in. So we've seen from John 1 that Peter was involved with John the Baptist along with his brother Andrew. We see the background of Peter being a stone, his name being changed, and his familiarity with the preaching of John and Isaiah 40. In Mark chapter 1, Jesus now, and this was only a few days after John 1's record, only a few days later, Jesus arrives, having travelled from where John was baptising, right down near the Dead Sea, up into Galilee. Peter and Andrew had already returned to Galilee and were fishing back at their occupation. And so obviously they had most of their time in their occupation and travelled down and spent time with John the Baptist. And now that John the Baptist had introduced them to, this is the Lamb of God, this is the one about whom I was speaking, they are ripe for the call. And so they receive it. And so we'll pick it up here. Verse 16. Now as he walked, that's Jesus walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew his brother casting a net into the sea, for they were fishers. And Jesus said unto them, come after me, and I will make you to become fishers of men. And straightway they forsook their nets and followed him. So here is the call of Peter and Andrew, Simon and Andrew his brother to become fishers of men. Come, follow me. Now this gets raised, obviously, in 1 Peter. It's our theme, if we can go back. Peter says to his readers at the end of chapter 2 that we must follow in his steps. And it's one of the great themes of his epistle. But this really encapsulates the call all from the beginning of his life, when he was called to follow Jesus, and straightway they forsook their nets and followed him. So there's a lot encapsulated in those two words, follow me. It's a simple invitation, but let's think about what this call really means. Because those two words, follow me, that we might follow in his steps, encapsulate so much. And when Jesus forsook those nets and followed Jesus, Peter did not understand what it would entail. And you know, when we accept the call of Jesus to follow him, when perhaps we're in our youth, or we first discover the truth of the gospel message of the Bible, and we accept it, we have some understanding of what it will mean. But think of Peter in those early days and how little he knew. Peter did not understand what it would entail to follow his master. But later, when he writes his first epistle, he has a much fuller understanding of what it means, and he expounds that for his readers. The call then is to all of us to follow Jesus. And when Peter reiterated this call in 1 Peter 2 verse 21, he says, for hereunto were you called. For hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that ye should follow in his steps. In these early days, Peter had no concept that the follow Jesus call would encapsulate suffering and so much of it. He had no concept that Messiah's walk would lead to the cross. This was something that was to come later. But nevertheless, Peter enthusiastically left all and followed. You'll notice that following Jesus means that we wholeheartedly forsake old ways for new. This is a characteristic of real discipleship, that we forsake completely old ways for new. And that's what Peter is going to advocate to his readers. In fact, he's going to call them aliens. Aliens in their world. They have so forsaken the world in which they live that they have become aliens in their society. They have been completely rejected by their community. And so following Jesus has serious consequences for our lives. Many of the consequences are unforeseen at the time we accept the call. So it was for Peter. But the call to follow could not be accepted by those who are half-hearted. Jesus tells a parable about this when he says, when some receive the call, they make excuses for not accepting the invitation. Oh, I have to look after my dying father, someone said. Or oh, I have to plough my field, another said in Luke 9 verse 60. Or I must first go home and say my goodbyes. I can't follow you now, I've got to go home to my family and say my goodbyes, Luke 9 verse 61. But you see here that Peter and his brother and his cousins, James and John, in the subsequent verses, all responded immediately and left all and forsook all and followed Jesus. But you know, it's not just a matter of your physical environment, of leaving behind a physical environment, your stuff of life, leaving that behind. It's a transformation inside and out, discipleship. Peter would be changed forever, never to be the same again. And so it is for us if we accept the discipleship of Jesus. In those early days, Peter could only see the miracles. He could see the extraordinary miracles, the healing and the teaching, and it was exhilarating, those early days of discipleship. But later, Peter would learn that there was more to discipleship than adrenaline-fed excitement and frantic activity. Discipleship at times is a lonely pathway, and where it led ultimately for Jesus to the suffering of the cross. And that was particularly lonely for him when even his friends, his disciples, forsook him and fled. Things got a lot harder as time went by. And so in Peter, it's not follow me to experience the hype and the miracles and the wonders. It's to follow me to the cross. Take up your cross and follow me. Let a man deny himself and so take up his cross and follow me. And so it's a sobering message that we hear. Peter, when he was first called, had a lot to learn, and don't we all? Peter, James and John became particularly close to Jesus. They were three of the disciples that were particularly close. Can we imagine what that experience must have been like for Peter to have been a close companion of the Lord himself for 3.5 years? Just an amazing thing. When the record records Peter's life, the record makes no bones about recording Peter's faults as well as his strengths. Peter made mistakes. I suspect a lesser man would not have been able to cope with faults being so publicly aired as they are in the Gospels. But Peter learned humility. He had quite a bit of pride in his early days, but he learned humility. Peter was outgoing. Peter was enthusiastic. Peter was at times impetuous. Peter was clearly a natural leader, and he often took the lead by virtue of that was his personality. He just said, right, let's go, and they went. There are four lists of disciples in the Gospels, and Peter heads them all. He is listed first in all four of the lists of disciples. There's a list in Matthew 10, in Mark 3, in Luke 6, and Acts chapter 1. And he always is listed first, and Judas is always listed last. And that's no accident that that is so. And of those 12, there were three that stood out, as I mentioned. And those three, Peter, James and John, were together for three special events. The resurrection of Jairus' daughter, and resurrection is a theme, a strong theme in Peter's epistle. The Mount of Transfiguration, and Peter talks about that glory that he saw on the Mount of Transfiguration in his epistle. And the Garden of Gethsemane, where the three were taken there to comfort the Lord, even though to some extent they failed to do so. And that suffering that Peter personally eyewitnessed in that garden becomes a subject in his epistle too. Peter makes a confident statement that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says to Peter at that time, playing on his name, thou art Peter, Petros, meaning a small stone. And upon this rock, Petra, will I build my ecclesia. And so he plays again on Peter's name in Matthew 16, verses 17 to 18, where Peter is going to be a stone, a movable stone, laid upon the rock which is the foundation of Christ, who was the foundation of the ecclesia. So Jesus is the cornerstone of which he spoke, and Peter was this stone that was to be a significant stone in the walls of the spiritual temple. And Peter was, of course, famous for that proclamation of his faith. But you know, it was only a short time later when Jesus was rebuking Peter for being a Satan. You're an adversary. Get behind me, Satan. And so Peter, you see in the Gospels, is this man vacillating between moments of great faith and strength and boldness and courage, and yet at other times, moments of failure. And so we have this man vacillating between these two things. You know, Peter's faith saw him say to the Lord, when none of the others were saying it, Lord, I want to come out and walk on the water with you. Amazing that he actually stepped out on the boat and expected to walk on water to his Lord. I mean, who would do that? Who would have the faith to do that? Peter did. And of course, then he looked around and got distracted by the waves around him and started to sink. And so we have this moment of high faith and then very quickly followed by a moment of weakness. Of course, we speak respectfully of Peter's weaknesses, you know, not knowing how we would fare in similar circumstances. But Peter is recorded in this way for us to see his moments of strength and weakness. And I think this is also a feature of his epistle, that he is so aware of human frailty. He does not expect the brothers and sisters to be perfect. He really understands that we struggle. We often struggle, and we need to be encouraged. Above all, we need to encourage one another and take one another by the hand and try to drag each other along with us to the kingdom. You know, that declaration at Caesarea Philippi, it was another example of that, those moments of high faith and then very soon after missing the point and perhaps failing. There was another one in the upper room, you'll remember, where Jesus takes up a towel and Jesus is washing the feet. And Peter says, "You're not washing my feet. You know, this is just wrong." And then Jesus says, "Well, you know, if I'm not going to wash your feet, you have no part with me." And Peter says, "Well, wash all of me then. You know, wash all of me." And Jesus says, "You're not understanding what I'm doing, Peter." And so we have this enthusiasm mixed with moments of misunderstanding. And then, of course, Peter, very soon after that, proclaims that he will never forsake his Lord. "Not if everyone forsakes you, Lord, I will never forsake you." And Jesus immediately says, "You'll forsake me three times tonight." And Peter just couldn't accept that that was so. And then sure enough, when Peter heard that cock crow, he went out and wept bitterly, knowing that he'd denied his Lord three times. And Peter exhorts the brothers and sisters in his first epistle to always be ready to give an answer for the hope that is in you. You know, Peter reflected on that failure, where Peter had found himself unexpectedly in a situation where people said, "Oh, you're with him." And he was sort of like taken aback, surprised. And said, no, I'm not with him." And they said again, "Yes, you're a Galilee. You've got that accent. You're with him." No. And three times in short succession, he denies his Lord and he's so embarrassed and bitterly disappointed in himself. And he says to the brothers and sisters, "Be ready always to give an answer for the hope that is in you." And we see Peter reflecting upon his life and both his strengths and his failures for the benefit of those to whom he is writing. After the Lord was raised, it is recorded that the Lord appeared to Peter specially on his own. In fact, he was the second person that Jesus appeared to. 1 Corinthians, we won't turn to it, but in 1 Corinthians 15, he appeared to Mary Magdalene and to Peter, and that appearance to Peter is not recorded anywhere except in 1 Corinthians 15. It was a private meeting with Peter, I believe, and I strongly believe that the Lord wanted to meet with Peter about that threefold denial that Peter was so bitterly disappointed about, and wanted to reassure Peter that he loved him despite that trial, that he'd failed. And so, again in John 21, we might just turn to John 21 to see that last conversation that's recorded in the Gospels between the Lord and Peter, which again becomes of substance when we read the first epistle. You know, at the beginning, Peter is called to be fishers of men. And here at the end of John, Peter is fishing and he's not catching any fish. And it's recorded that Jesus yells out and they don't know who he is, "Why don't you throw the net on the other side?" And Peter's like, "What? You know, I'm the fisherman, who are you?" And yet they put their net on the other side and they caught all these fish. Yet was not the net broken. So they didn't lose any. And Jesus said, "Come and dine." And of course Peter recognised that it was the Lord. And he jumps out of the boat in enthusiasm and goes and sees that Jesus has already caught fish and he has them cooking on the fire and breakfast is prepared. You've got the disciples out there on the lake unable to catch fish, but Jesus has already not only caught the fish, brought them to shore, and has them prepared for a meal. And Peter learns to follow the master. You know, this is a master who is master of all things. and Peter is to be fishers of men likewise. And Jesus asks three times of Peter, "Do you love me?" in this last conversation. And there's no doubt there's an echo there of the threefold denial, and that Jesus is making Peter reflect upon his commitment. Do you love me? Yes, you know I love me. Second time, do you love me? Yes, you know I love me. I love you. And then the third time, Peter is grieved at his heart that he asks a third time, do you love me? You know, there's two reasons why he was grieved. Because he asked a third time. An echo of that threefold denial, which still would have grieved Peter, still would have hurt him deeply. But also, the third time Jesus asked, do you love me? He changed the word from, do you love me, agape, to do you philio me? Which is a lower form of love in the Greek. It's brotherly love as opposed to self-sacrificial love. And it's like the third time Peter's asked, do you even philio me, Peter? And Peter is grieved because he says, you know all things, Lord. You know I love you. I can't really, after denying you three times, overstate my commitment, can I? Peter's aware of this. But he says, you know I love you. And he felt aggrieved that he was questioning him in this way. And yet, this was a refinement of Peter. This was no doubt a refinement of Peter. And three times, Peter is told, you're given a commission to feed my sheep. Which is a theme taken up in Peter again, in 1 Peter 5, where he talks to the elders and he says, feed the flock of God. Not as overlords. Not as overlords, but willingly. You know, not for filthy lucre, not for yourself, but for the benefit of them. And so we have this other echo being brought out. And so you can see that all these things and many more from Peter's life are brought into the epistle. And Peter is reflecting upon his whole life. All right, now I just want to talk now about the readers. Actually, before I do that, just at the end of John 21. After this third time, we'll pick it up in verse 17. He saith a third time, Simon, son of Jonah, lovest thou me? And Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? And that's the word philio there, whereas agape on the previous two occasions. And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. Verily, verily, he says, I say unto you, when you were young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee, and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. Now, what on earth does that mean? He says, when you were young, you decided where you went. You made decisions about how you went there, and what you did, and what you wore, and how you dressed. But when you're old, other people are going to make those decisions for you. And what was he getting at? Verse 19 explains it. This spake he, that's Jesus, signifying by what death he should glorify God. What Jesus is doing here for Peter is he's predicting his death. Peter's death. This is a prediction that Peter would be crucified. And so he was. And it was the death by which he should glorify God. And that little phrase, glorify God, is taken up and repeated time and again in 1 Peter. Because the people to whom Peter was writing were being called upon to give their lives in a time of great persecution. And Peter says, your death will glorify God if you stay faithful and firm unto the end. Peter himself was writing from Rome, where he himself was going to give his life in this very way that Jesus was predicting, where he would be crucified. Now Peter, Eusebius records, early church fathers record, when Peter was led away to be crucified, Peter requested, well, he first saw his wife crucified in front of him. They crucified his wife. We know Peter had a wife because you might remember Jesus healed his wife's mother. And in 1 Corinthians 10, it records that, 1 Corinthians 9, sorry, it records that Peter travelled around the ecclesial world with his wife, assisting him in the preaching work. And They were like a husband and wife team. Unlike Paul, who wasn't married, Peter travelled with his wife and were a very effective team in supporting the early ecclesias. But Peter saw his wife crucified in front of him, so early church fathers tell us, and then he himself, after seeing his wife crucified, requested that he be crucified upside down because he didn't feel worthy to share the death of his Lord. And when Jesus had spoken this and predicted Peter's death in this way, he said unto him, "Follow me." Hang on, haven't these words already been said? Weren't they said 3.5 years ago and Peter accepted the invitation? These words, this call, this invitation now has greater meaning for Peter, doesn't it? The previous verse says, "You are going to be crucified. Now, follow me." Now you understand what it means to be a disciple of your Lord. And then Peter, turning about, seeth the disciple whom Jesus loved following, that's John, which also leaned on his breast at supper, and said, "Lord," that's in relation to supper, "at the supper, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee?" John said that, so he questioned. Verse 21, Peter saith to the Lord, or saith to Jesus, "Lord, what shall this man do?" And so Jesus says, "Follow me, you've got to follow me to death." And he turns around and sees John following him and saying, "Hey, what about him?" And Jesus said, "If I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me." And so he makes an allusion there to perhaps to the fact that John was going to live the longest of the disciples. And so he did. AD 96, he was exiled to Patmos and wrote the Revelation there. And this is a prophecy of John's elongated life in contrast to Peter's crucifixion. "And then went this saying that abroad among the brethren that disciple should not die. Yet Jesus said, not unto him, he shall not die, but if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee?" So it was never predicted that John would not die, but there was perhaps an allusion there to his longer life. But for Peter, his death was determined here, right here, in this epistle. And when Peter, in this gospel, when Peter wrote the first epistle, he was only months away from that very death. He was caught up in the persecution that the believers to whom he was writing were also caught up. So now I want to talk about the readers briefly. In 1 Peter chapter 1, we're told the location of the readers. It says here they're scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia and Bithynia. On the map, that's the area that's circled there. They were a group of brothers and sisters in Asia Minor. Now, you'll notice here that Asia and Bithynia were areas where Paul was specifically prevented in Acts 16 by the Spirit from visiting when he was preaching. So Paul did not preach in that northeastern area of Turkey, modern-day Turkey. He went in the southern and the western rim of Turkey, and remember, the Spirit took him up into Macedonia and over there into Greece and Macedonia in that second missionary journey, and he never really got up into those areas. It's probable that they were areas that Peter himself visited. And so he's writing to ecclesias and brothers and sisters that he knew personally and visited with his wife earlier. These people are also mentioned among those that heard Peter preach in Acts chapter 2 at Pentecost. 30 years before he wrote 1 Peter, there were representatives of these areas at Pentecost. It says that in Acts chapter 2. Peter preached on the day of Pentecost to an audience which included visitors from Pontus, Cappadocia and Asia, three areas specifically mentioned. And they may have met Peter, got baptised and gone back and established ecclesias which Peter and his wife subsequently visited. The date of writing of 1 Peter is about 65 to 67 AD. Probably the Apostle Paul had just recently been executed under the mad Emperor Nero, which we're going to talk about in a minute. Peter's own death was not far away. The Emperor Nero was on the throne. Now, up until Emperor Nero came to the throne, or a bit after, The early Christians had enjoyed a period of peace and stability. They had been seen as a troublesome but small, insignificant subset of the Jews, really. They were perhaps annoying at times, but not worthy of too much attention. But that officially changed during Nero's reign. He was the first emperor of Rome to instigate official decrees against the Christians. Nero began the first Gentile persecution of the followers of Jesus. It all started with a fire in Rome in AD 64, where a large percentage of the city was burnt to the ground. There were valued temple areas destroyed. There were valued public and private buildings destroyed in that fire. And it was postulated by many that the fire was actually started at the instigation of the mad Emperor Nero. The reason or the motivation that he had was that he wanted to rebuild Rome for himself, for his own name. He wanted to rebuild these public buildings that were burnt by the fire. And so it was a charge was brought against Nero that he burnt these buildings to the ground. Now, he had to divert attention from this rumour. Now, Tacitus, who was a Roman historian and a primary source, wrote these words. And he wrote these words about Nero's reign. He said, "Nero falsely directed the charge of lighting the fire onto a set of people to whom the Vulgar gave the name of Christians, and who were to be detested for the abominations they perpetrated." There's a couple of points to take from this passage. The charges against the Christians were not initiated by some small town official. They came right from the top, the emperor himself. And so, from that time on, every city and town official in the Roman Empire with an eye on a job in Rome would take the lead and the license to persecute Christians because of this decree from Rome. It also mentions here that they were called Christians as a form of insult, Christ's ones. And there were maybe songs and derogatory chants that would have been part of the culture of persecution now of these of our brothers and sisters. It says here that they were to be detested. Detested. Officially detested. And they perpetrated abominations. That's what the decree of Nero said. Up until this time, Christianity was a legal religion. It wasn't outlawed. And the fact that the Christians were considered to be a subset of the Jews actually inflamed the Jews. And the Jews hated the fact that the Christians, who were enemies of theirs, were seen as being just a subset of the Jews. And the Jews actually lobbied the emperor to inform him that that was not the case, that they had nothing to do with the Christians. And in fact, it's known that Nero had a lot of Jews in his court, and his second wife was actually a Jewess, Pompeo. And his favourite actress, it is well known, was also a Jewess, Aleteris. And these Jews who were significant in Nero's life would certainly have been used to influence the emperor to turn against the Christians. So the Jews were trying to influence the emperor to turn against the Christians and to make a decree against them. Which is ironic, given the fact that a few hundred years down the track, the Christians would become the dominant empire, religion in the empire, and would persecute the Jews. But the Jews at this stage used their influence to turn Nero against the Christians. And so Nero declared Christianity religio illicita, which is Latin for illegal religion. And Nero made proclamations against them. Nero subjected believers to brutal and horrific tortures. Believers were sewn in animal skins and left to be mauled by the dogs. They were thrown into the amphitheatres. They were rolled in pitch. They were elevated on crosses and lit up, burnt to illuminate Nero's garden parties. And so they were like Christmas lights for Nero's garden parties. And Nero entertained his friends with such atrocities, committed against our brothers and sisters who held firmly to our faith. Nero invited them to recant their faith. If they recanted their faith, they would be let go free. If they stood firm and said, we believe in Jesus Christ, we believe he is the Messiah, and so on, if they proclaimed that they were followers of Christ, they would be put on stakes and burnt, they would be thrown to the lions, their loved ones would be tortured in front of them, and so on. Imagine the fear. Imagine the fear that our brothers and sisters lived under at this time. Now, these areas that Peter was writing to had Roman governors throughout that followed the decrees of Caesar. And in every town, in every village in which ecclesias were dotted, the Christians were hunted out. And there were lists drawn up and given to the governors anonymously. And Pliny the Younger, another Roman writer, makes reference to this, that the Roman governors were given anonymous lists of people who were accused of being Christians. And it ended up being a massive witch hunt. Now, Tacitus here goes on to say that mockery of all sorts was added to their deaths. There arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to satisfy one man's cruelty that they were being destroyed. Now, from this passage here, it's noted these following points. The Christians were being cruelly executed, put to death. These are our brothers and sisters. But they were not only being cruelly executed, but all kinds of mockery was being added to their deaths. They were being humiliated in the tortures they had to endure. In fact, this makes clear that Nero was so cruel in his persecution and so effective that even the general populace felt it may not be in the public good to be so cruel to this group of people. Even the pagan Romans began to feel a little bit repulsed about the extent of the atrocity. Even the pagan Romans felt a little bit squeamish about the extent of the humiliation and the mockery and the torture of our brothers and sisters. And they wondered whether they were stepping over the line. These people that went to the amphitheatres and saw people killed for sport. It was during this persecution of Nero that the beloved Apostle Paul met his end. He was executed in Rome as a prisoner of this cruel emperor. Can you imagine the effect on the ecclesial world of the news of Paul's death? He had been loved by so many, and now he was executed, now he was dead. For many, their spiritual father was gone and they were alone just when things were getting really difficult for themselves. Peter himself knew that his life, the length of his life was limited, and he himself, whether he knew it or not, would be killed under this same persecution of Nero. And as I mentioned, he was forced to watch his own wife crucified in front of him, and then he himself was put to death by the same means, requesting only one variation, and that being that he was crucified upside down because he didn't feel worthy to share the exact same death of his Lord. So record the early Christian fathers. Peter also, in his writing of 1 Peter, warned the believers that there was more to come. They were enduring this kind of persecution, but it wasn't going to stop with Nero. Only a few decades later, Domitian also ascended the throne, and he turned on the Christians again with even greater ferocity than Nero. And this was to become part of the experience of following the Lord, suffering, taking up your cross and denying yourself, started to mean something really literal and tangible. And many of our brothers and sisters had to see their loved ones tortured to death. And the only way they could save them was to recant their religion. What a trial that would be. Also hovering in the background of this epistle around this time was the fact that the cruel destruction of the Jewish people in Jerusalem and Judea and in the northern area also was about to start. And this would be also very real for the brothers and sisters who had been Jewish and had become Christians, and also were being persecuted because they were Jews, not just Christians, but they were Jews. And so for two reasons they were being persecuted. And around this time, just after Nero left the throne, Vespasian was involved in destroying Jerusalem. So this is the background of the epistle. There's an artist's impression of Christians praying as they wait for the lions to eat them. This is another artist's impression of the same thing, with people being eaten alive by lions. That's an example of Peter's net. And this is Peter's epistle, a net to catch men. And at its centre is the subject of suffering. These are two subsidiary themes that are introduced in verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers, that's the word aliens, and actually the word in verse 2, elect, in the Greek, occurs right next to the word aliens. So Peter is saying, I am writing to elect aliens. Now what is puzzling about that phrase, that Peter is writing to elect, chosen, aliens? There's like a paradox there. Can you see the paradox? That the brothers and sisters were elect, chosen, special, holy, peculiar, all these words that he brings up throughout his epistle, and it becomes a theme of his epistle that they are elect and special and holy. But beside that, juxtaposed to that, they were aliens in the world in which they lived. And this is really the dichotomy that our brothers and sisters live with. This is the problem. This is the challenge of daily life. That as far as the world was concerned, they were aliens, they were strangers, they were rejected, they were repulsed by them. And yet to God, they must remember always that they are special. And so, we've just introduced our main theme for the epistle, and tomorrow morning we're going to go on with this theme of suffering. But I just want to give you the kind of flavour of the things Peter's going to talk about. Anxiety, reproach, vilification, trials, alienation, fear, uncertainty, rejection. They were non-citizens. They were unsettled. They didn't belong in their society. They were totally rejected. And they were hunted down. This was a real problem. And Peter was writing to these brothers and sisters who were enduring this suffering. And so in our exhortation, we're going to turn to this subject of suffering, consider what our brothers and sisters were enduring and how the Apostle Peter encouraged them to hold firm to the faith, the trial of their faith, which was much more precious than of gold which perishes, and see the encouragement of Peter as he tries to get the brothers and sisters who are enduring this level of trial to follow Jesus to the end. And if that end means death, so be it. Because Jesus himself, that's where his life ended. And we must be prepared to suffer with our Lord to the end, if necessary, to demonstrate our faith in God.